Howdy ho, everybody. Time for another Shop Talk show. This is episode number 230. Just Dave and I, we're going to talk about a bit about a big thing that's happening in my life, book that I just dropped, Practical SVG. I know I've mentioned it a little bit in previous weeks, but I thought we'd take some time to actually talk about what it is, how it went down, who it's for, all the kind of stuff that's inside it. I thought that we would take a half of the show to talk about that. And then in the second half of the show, we'll get into some Q&A, more rapid fire stuff that like we normally do. We're going to talk a bit about AMP. We're going to talk about whether you should include a photo on a personal site, kind of an interesting subject there. We're going to talk a bit about grids and Suzy and that whole world in an interesting way. So that and more coming up. I should mention that this show is brought to you by Codascope Jax. Jax is a fascinating thing. You kind of like point it at your repos and it will do like this deep analysis and figure out like what's going on with your app, specifically in regard to security and some things like that. And it gives you recommendations for what can be improved and automatic patches to fix the stuff and expert training. It's literally free for developers to use for an unlimited number of repositories. Sign up at codascope.com/shoptalk. That URL will be in the show notes as well. For now, Mr. Dave, kick things off.
Hey there, Shopper Maniacs! You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is author, professional blogger, Chris Coyer.
Yay! Yeah, I am those things. I was technically a book author before, because many, many years ago I wrote this book, Digging into WordPress, still exists. That's the URL for it, too. It was a different journey, though, than my current book that just dropped, which is called Practical SVG, available on Book Apart. We'll put the link in the show notes and stuff. I've mentioned it the past couple of weeks, which is a different sort of book. It's just, you know, it's more modern, more relevant to me because it's new. So I thought we'd be dumb not to do at least a little bit of, like, talking about it and stuff because it's just it's related to me and what I do in the world. So like I mentioned at the top of the show, let's talk about the book a little bit, just for maybe half the show. Then we'll do some Q&A at the end of it. And then next week, just as a teaser, we're going to talk more about book writing, but with other book authors and less so about their books. But what about book writing is relevant to their life and career and things like that? So we have some special guests next week. But this week, just Dave and I talking about that stuff.
Yeah, so the Book Apart Fairy came to my door and delivered me a nice blue book.
Yeah.
Chris, you got blue. That's a good color for you.
It was, and in fact, it was the first choice because, you know, who you work with is the famous, we've mentioned many times and have had him on the show, Jason Santamaria is the designer of the Book Apart books, which, you know, you could scarcely do better for a designer in this day and age. They're very amicable about what color you get. You know, you can't just randomly pick a thing. It's got to go through, you know, it's got to go through JSM. But one of his ideas was this blue right away. And he's just like, oh, it's the, I think it's a nice shade of blue. And just as a little aside, it's about the same color as like when you're an illustrator and have selected some vector objects. And it's like the little tiny blue squares that represent the dots on the vector paths. I'm like, OMG, that's super perfect. And then I was like, well, let's make sure it's the exact hex code or whatever of that, the exact values of it. And I like sampled it and sent that back to him and it already was that. So I bet, I think he probably like literally color sampled from one of those dots. And I'm like, dude, done, ship it. That's the blue I want. And a lot of people have commented that it's just a nice blue color anyway, not even knowing its kind of secret history. So.
Yeah, that's hella nerdy, but really, really good.
It is, and not everybody uses Illustrator for vector stuff, and none of the other apps use that same blue.
Yeah, Chris, what about Sketch?
Yeah, well, Sketch is great.
Yeah. So, explain, can we back up? Like, so they came to you, they said, Chris, you do a successful podcast. We know about your work. We would like you to write a book. Is that sort of how that all went?
It kind of does. I don't even remember what day one was, but I'm just, you know, lucky in a sense that, like, I kind of know some of the people involved just through being involved with web and web publishing and conferences and stuff for as long as I have. So, you know, I've spoken at an event apart, as you have a number of times. And while those aren't, like, super directly related, they are related, you know, it's all a little bit confusing. They're actually different companies, but they just both happen to involve Zeldman and,
yeah, I'm just trying to figure out why you have one and I don't. It's kind of really just blowing
my
mind.
Well, we had Cattell on the show, and she clearly offered you the an open door to it. Yeah. I don't think that's a, you know, you first of all, you have to have a good idea, of which pour out of you like rain. So,
oh, I have tons of ideas. I got tens of books, binders full of books. But this, okay, so sorry, break it down real serious, but you gave like in 2014, I think it was a really good SVG talk, kind of like,
2015 kind of, as well. It really kind of transcended the year boundary, but that's a very important part to all this is that, you know, I've met and you have book ideas. A lot of people have had book ideas. Some people even call me up and say, you know, I want to write a book. What's it like? You know, I heard, and I just was on Christopher Schmidt's podcast, Non-Breaking Space, and the same thing came up. And it was a little moment that I'm sure he doesn't remember, but Ethan Marcotte, I was overhearing a conversation at one point of somebody else that's like, oh, Ethan, I love your book. I want to write a book too. And Ethan's like, here's an idea, perhaps. Make it a blog post first. You know, like write a blog post because, you know, he's just recounting his own experience with responsive web design. The book started from that seminal blog post on List Apart and then grew up from there. And then it, you know, and I was like, yeah, absolutely. You know, I'd just be like, I got a book idea and just go from zero to book. I would write about it at least once, if not many times. And then in my case, it wasn't just writing about it, which I did do many, many times. Then I turned it into a talk. Then I turned it into another talk. I evolved both of those talks. And it just was like, by the time book writing came about, it was like, I have a ton of source material here. It's not going to be easy, but it's easier than starting from scratch. Like, I've already, like, told the story of what I want to say about SVG. Now I need to really refine it, change how I tell that story because the book format is a bit different. But I wasn't going from absolute scratch. It was lots of experience, both in using SVG and in telling other people how to use SVG.
So to kind of borrow from our Donna Lacha episode, you kind of had the story arc, sort
of. I did.
And
I mean,
then
which developed in the talks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it was just a matter of sort of putting it all together, huh?
Yeah, which was incredibly time consuming, even for such a short book. You know, it was write it and then go through all the editing processes, of which is very, you know, they're a very legit publisher. You have to go through their steps.
I have questions. I have like tons of questions about that whole, like, because I kind of knew you were doing this, and I'm doing that book, and it was like, okay, when? Yeah. And it sort of took a little bit of a while, but I think it was just because you were working and starting a company at the same time. But I have questions about that. But I guess why SVG? What it's so hot right now. I think we went to, we have another episode, the CSS DevConf episode, where we went to like four talks in a row on SVG, all by women, by the way, which was great. But so it was four talks in a row on SVG. Why is it so hot right now? What makes SVG the cool?
I kind of mentioned it in the book a little bit. That is a strong point, though. Like, what the heck is it that makes SVG so hot right now? And is it really? Or is it just like people talking about it a lot, but it's not actually that hot in reality, in usage or whatever, which I think there's probably some truths to both. But the perfect storm is that it just makes sense. It should have been around since day one of the web. And in fact, it is rather old as a concept. But it's just like, dude, I want to like draw a line from this point to this point on the screen. I should be able to do that, right? And the web's like, nope, not really.
Oh, buddy. No. Oh, God. No. You poor bastard. No.
But I mean, that's not entirely fair because there's canvas. But I mean, SVG makes it really easy. Oh, there's a polyline attribute and it takes 2x, you know, or xxy points, nxy points, and just draws a line between them. It's just a format that makes sense. Of course, there should be vector graphics on the web. The web is absolutely perfect for it. They're very efficient. They look very sharp. And, you know, a lot of this actually came about during the, it almost feels old school to us already, which was like the Retina apocalypse or whatever, where everybody's like, oh no, my graphics look like garbage on these new high density pixel density displays or whatever, what shall I do? And everybody's like, I know, let's make double the size of images, which are really four times the file size because of just how it works, you know, with width and height. And a lot of people did that, and it was kind of fine. And then everybody's like, oh, my God, the page weight is crazy, and performance got involved and was like, we need to solve this from a specs perspective, which is where all that picture element and source set stuff came in. That was successful. But during that whole time, a lot of people were like, well, for a certain kind of graphic, SVG's better – even better than the 1X versions were. So it's like, duh, you know, vector graphics on the web. I got into it just because of duh, essentially. You know, like, it's just obvious. They look fantastic in their tiny file size. How could you not use it? I think part of it why I'm so interested in evangelizing it, as it were, is because it's totally underused as well. Like, is it, like, answering the question, is SVG that hot these days? You know, yes and no. Like, yeah, there's a lot of people talking about it. There's a lot of people using it to great effect, but not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think the book is somewhat well-timed. I wish it came out a little earlier even. You know, it'd be cool to have dropped 2 years ago. I wasn't the person to write it 2 years ago, but that would have, it would, you know, and it's not like this is the only book or the only person evangelizing it. I am far from that, by the way, but it's just, you know, it helps. I've helped push it along a little bit. There's plenty of people that are just like, they know about it, they hear about it, but they're kind of avoiding it. The book is perfect for you. You know, maybe this is your excuse to stop avoiding it. And there needs to be some muscle memory built up to like, oh yeah, shoot, this graphic actually kind of looks like it's in that SVG territory kind of thing. But like, I just don't want to deal with it right now. I don't want to think about it. I'm just gonna export a PNG like I always do. There's some muscle memory that you can start to fight and build for like, no, this is vector, so it really should be SVG. The benefits are there, so I'm going to start doing it. Maybe this book is your ticket to start building that muscle memory.
Yeah, no, I think there can be way more SVG. At the last event apart I spoke at, I did like a who's using SVG and a lot of hands went up, and then who's animating SVG and like two or three hands went up, you know, out of a crowd of like 200 or 300 or something. No,
that
so,
brings up a good point that it's not just SVG. It's like there's a million ways you can use it.
Yeah, it's kind of, I was just thinking, it's kind of the like perfect playground where JavaScript, CSS, and HTML or XML, let's say, all came together, and they're just like, let's play, let's have fun. We are buddies. We are not,
it's really, that's
sworn enemies.
It's a document format like HTML is. They happen to be able to kind of like live in inside of each other as needed. But like that's why it's different than a format like JPEG, which is just like, this is just like an algorithm for compressing pixel data together. SVG is just like, I'm just this declarative format for declaring what some graphics can look like. You want to run some JavaScript inside of me? Fine. I am a document format. I accept that. You want to put a style block inside me? I'm cool with that, you know? You want to like declaratively declare what an animation could be like inside me. I have a syntax for that too that's largely deprecated, but
I have a really not useful syntax for
that. It's way more complicated than HTML as a document format. It's,
yeah, I mean, you know, everyone, so HTML, it's got whatever, 180 elements or whatever, and people are, oh, that's so much. And then you got CSS, which like thousands of properties, and it's like, oh, that's too much. But SVG kind of adds a whole other thing. I mean, elements wise, it's like path and polygon and all that, but you get into what, like the filters and the, I don't even know what they are. FE, gradient. Is that one? Is that one?
No, that's FE's.
F gradient. F stop.
Gradient is just what is gradient? Gradient elements. I can't even remember offhand because they're so strange. They're called linear gradient and radial gradient, and then there's stop elements as well. The FE ones are like really weird filter things. I don't even know that much about that stuff. That's the thing. Like, I feel underqualified to talk about SVG in lots of ways. And I'm sure plenty of people agree with me on that I am underqualified to talk about. But I don't use that stuff all that much. And hopefully the title of the book lends itself to that. It's not like super niche complicated things about SVG. This book particularly, and my personal use of SVG, is pretty surface level. It's like extracting all of the benefits of a lot of the like easy stuff to pull off with SVG, like making an icon system. You know, like there's a whole chapter in that in the book, and I've been kind of hounding that for years on how I think it makes such a good there's a symbol element in SVG, for crying out loud. That's what it's for. It's like declare a symbol and then use the symbol on the page. That's why it was designed. That's why it was created. It's super perfect for that. But yeah, like, I know a little bit about that. It's not like I know absolutely nothing about filters and stuff. In fact, there's a chapter that does cover some of that stuff at a kind of a high level, or at least kind of opens your eyes to it. And that stuff, if anybody out there wants to dig into the world of SVG filters, the world is ready for you. Please do that.
I guess should we do like a chapter by chapter walkthrough of what you kind of wrote about, just to whet people's appetites for what they can learn?
I could probably do it in like 2 minutes.
All right, I'm setting a timer. Siri, set time.
Sure. It tries to read narratively. You can pick it up and whatever, but this is the narrative of it, is that it starts off by telling you that you can put an SVG in an image tag. So you can have image source equals dog.svg, and it's like, if that's all you learned, that's great, because that's highly empowering. You can use SVG today in the same way you can use JPEG and stuff for the most part. That's amazing, but then it starts to get into that, like, okay, when do I reach for that and when do I not? There's some really obvious examples of when you should and some really obvious examples of when you shouldn't, but there's a swath of gray area in between, which the more you learn about SVG, the narrower that gray area becomes and the better choices that you can make. So it's just really basics in the beginning. Then it talks about some of the software you can use, because it's kind of like, if you want to be empowered with SVG, you need tooling of some kind or another, and some of the most common toolings across platform we get into a little bit. Then I just wanted to take the bull by the horns and do the icon system. Let's talk about it. It's awesome for that. It can be this watershed moment with you and SVG, because it teaches you a ton about the format and about the tooling around it at once, while giving your website a really beautiful system to work with for icons. So I kind of talk about doing it manually at first, and you know, we learn some things about SVG along the way, and then get into like, you don't have to do this by hand. Let's talk about build tools. There's tons of tooling like Grunt and Gulp and the like to help you in SVG land. I use it all the time. That was, not to overuse this word, but a watershed moment for me as well, that I kind of call out in the book. Like when I learned that I could start like taking a folder full of SVGs and like batch processing them to do stuff for my website, that was a big deal. So we talk all about that in chapter 4. Then that builds, like, now that we have this tooling like at our fingertips, what else can we make it do? So in chapter 5, I talk about, well, let's make those build tools optimize our SVG for us. So just like you can optimize all kinds of other stuff, like your CSS, you can compress it, you can gzip it, you can just be more efficient as you're writing it as you go. All the same stuff applies to SVG in different ways. So chapter 5 is all about optimizing it. Not, you know, you can squeeze, using SVG period is performant generally, but you can squeeze even more out of it. And generally, the savings are like kind of amazing with SVG. Then the rest of the book is like things you should just know how SVG works. Like sizing is a little weird in SVG. You got this view box thing that you really kind of got to understand, because it's weird, but it's powerful. So you might as well get it.
And yeah, I still like half understand it. You know,
yeah.
It's like,
Yeah.
I'll just fudge these numbers and see what happens.
Because it's weird. Like a JPEG, you're like, be 200 pixels wide and 100 pixels tall. And JPEG's like, fine. And it'll squish into that shape. Or, you know, we have image cover these days to make sure it doesn't squish. But, like, that's kind of the thing. And in SVG land is like, there's so many different ways. You can be like, well, okay, I can squish into that space if you want. Or I can draw myself at the perfect aspect ratio and be right in the middle of it. Or I can maintain my perfect aspect ratio and be on the left side or right side or a particular corner or whatever. It's like you have all the power you'd ever want in sizing and scaling SVG. You just got to kind of know what attributes do what, and that's pretty useful. Then we get into the animating, of course, because that's such a big deal. It's so powerful. You have all these drawing elements with SVG. You might as well be able to take that to the next level and move them around. Indeed, there are lots of powerful ways you can do that, which I love and cover in Chapter 7. And then the last fun chapter is like, why don't we talk about filters and some of the other like kind of just fun stuff you can do in SVG, just so you know that they're there. And, I kind of end the book just being like, I just want you to know what the possibilities are so that like when a situation comes across, you know, they're like, oh yeah, SVG has got this so that you can dig into it later while there's referencing this book or finding other resources. And the book is just full of resources elsewhere. Yeah.
Nice.
Well. So that I probably went over 2 minutes there. That's all the chapters of it, and it's the book apart mantra is that you can read it on a plane kind of thing. You know, it's short. You know, and it comes in EPUB and PDF and Mobi, so you can read it on your Kindle or whatever. They take care in making really nice mobile versions of it, and that's $9 for all. You know, for all.
I was going to say, how much is it going to set me back?
Literally, it's $9 for the ebooks, and then if you want the paperback, it's double that, $18. But that's still pretty dang cheap. Digging into WordPress was $75.
So $9 to learn a new skill.
$22.50 if you want them both, which I recommend. It's a lovely looking blue book. You can see it and hold it. I'm holding it now, flipping through it.
And A Book Apart does a pretty good job, just in general, in my experience, not an advertisement for them, although if they want me to write a book for them, I'm totally open. They do a really good job of, like, you read the book, and then you're like, I have a pretty good understanding of that, what I just read about, whether it's responsive web design or just HTML5 or, you know, SaaS for designers. I think it was you kind of, like, walk away with, like, a little bit of, like, a I feel that. I got a baseline. I'm caught up on the conversation. I didn't have to like go through 100 blog posts. I'm here. I can play this game now. And I feel like they do a really good job of that, you know?
Sure. I haven't read every single one of them, but I've read a lot of them for that reason. So I like know what the current conversation is around that, because these books, even if they're not directly for you, are kind of, I don't know, milestones in the conversation around subjects in a way. And they kind of, that's one of the reasons for writing a book, which I think we'll talk about more next week with other book authors, is that kind of milestone setting thing in the industry. If it does nothing else, it does that a little bit.
Well, cool. So who needs to buy this book? Who's
right. I mean, that does lend itself to that pretty much. Like if you've never heard me through any blog post or this show or any of the other ways that I like say stuff about the web, if you are totally uncompelled by SVG, or you know a lot about SVG and I've never said anything that you didn't already know, maybe this isn't for you. Maybe you know a good amount about SVG. It's not an advanced SVG book necessarily. I'd say it's, but also like, you know, literally because a lot of my family has attempted to read it and stuff, and they all give me that cliche, like, you know, this is pure gibberish, I don't understand a word in here. it's not for somebody who has absolutely no idea about the web either. I would not be like, oh, you're learning websites, read my book Practical SVG. You're just gonna shrug and have no idea. Like it's not for absolute beginners either. You should have some basic knowledge of HTML, and I would say, at least, you know. So it's an intermediate book. It's like, I build websites. I've heard about SVG. I want to level up there a little bit. And like I said, build that kind of muscle memory towards using SVG and just be caught up and know what's going on about SVG. So not for the total beginners, not for super advanced SVG people, but for a wide swath of people in the middle I think could benefit from it, because I can't, you know, like by the time this come out, you know, I was, you go through in the book building process, like a little bummer part of the process, you know, when you've been working on it forever and you just like, you can barely see the light at the end of the tunnel, practically to the point where you're like, I don't even care if they publish this thing for me, you know.
Is that the, yeah, okay. Isn't there a startup term for this? Like the... Oh, I forget. Oh, okay.
There probably is. But yeah, it gets that bad. It definitely does, to the, you know, to the just like, why does nothing matters anymore kind of thing. But the more, you know, not, then when it's out and you start feeling more yourself about this thing, I hear from people all the time that are just like, I just don't use it enough. I'm like afraid of it, or like, I just haven't tried it enough. I need a kick in the pants to get into it. You know, let this be the kick in the pants. And know that internet-wide, definitely not enough people are using SVG. It's like, you know, I almost collect examples of it. I am, because I have a new talk I'm putting together of examples where I'm looking on the web. I'm like, oh, that's probably SVG, or if it's not, it should be. And oh, it's not, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not like shame on them. It's just like they could use this knowledge probably.
Yeah.
People don't know. They just, you know, it's a big internet out there.
You know, I told a designer the other week about how you can just copy an SVG or a Illustrator document and paste it like into a code pen, and it's an SVG. And they're like, "No way!" And then they're like, "So could I like animate things in the SVG?" And I was like, "Yeah, huh? Yeah." Oh yeah, we can do that. I mean, that's probably something we should like layer on later. Like that's not a part of the minimum viable product, but that's something we can do if we want to do that.
That's a great example of something that you didn't know and now you do know, and a good example of like, oh shoot, now how do I? It's gonna probably come across as like a weird size when you do that, because it's like Illustrator doesn't know what your intentions are for sizing. So that's like a good chapter that would go with chapter 6, because it's like, oh shoot, now I need, like, I get what it's doing here. I can see my shape, but it's not what I intended. It's just like a weird chunk sitting over here. I need to adjust some attributes and values and stuff to position it. Oh, now I have it just right. Now I can animate it or color it or do what I want to do.
Yeah. No, there's kind of, I mean, I think it's just, ignorance is maybe the right term, but it just, people don't know because they aren't using it day to day, and so they don't know what it can do. And but that's cool. So can I ask a couple book questions? I won't go too deep because we are doing a whole book show, but how long did you work on this? You said you got depressed in the middle, so that makes me think like you went through a few seasons of
kind of. I mean, it was, there's only me really to blame for it, but it was just kind of like, it went fast in the beginning and then slower. Cause it's kind of like, I don't know, you write it and then there's kind of a lot of stuff that you got to change. And then then it comes back to you with like 2,500 little things that you need to approve or rewrite or look at and check out, and it's just like, God, that's gonna take me forever. Because it's kind of like, I think it depends on editor, but at one point we were in Pages, and then Pages just started, it was really, the book was long, as short as it is, it's still a really long Pages file, that Mac software, and it was just slow and crashing and awful, which just like slowed down my enthusiasm for editing. And then we moved to Microsoft Word, which is a fine product, and I think that was Chris really changed my life for the better. Yeah. Microsoft Word did it. And then it was fast and performant, and I was able to kind of get through the edits. But that happens back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, which is great, because I mean, there was in early drafts of this, I made like a, this is just one minor example, I made like a your mom joke kind of thing that just was totally inappropriate and would have been awful in the final thing. And that's what editors, they read every sentence perfectly, not only for grammar and stuff. Of course they do that. In fact, that doesn't even happen till like the end, practically. The beginning stages of editing are like wide swaths. Let's move this up here and this down here, and this doesn't make sense here and stuff. Then it gets finer grained and finer grained and finer grained, and the editing passes, and the spelling and stuff doesn't even happen till the way end.
Wow. So I guess what was your relationship like with the editor? I mean, was it pretty good? You just kind of
Yeah, lots of passes. In fact, most of the conversation actually happens like in Word documents because each little change has its own little thread of comments and like, I meant this. Oh, I see. Well, what about this? Oh, sorry, I meant to change that too. You know, a lot of our, we probably have communicated more in little chat bubbles in Microsoft Word than we did in Slack or anything.
Oh, wow. So then I guess does it, you have like a blog, you know how to write, you know how to publish and edit and do all these things. Is it weird inviting somebody else into that process? Do you feel like you lose your voice or?
No, I thought they brought out the voice even better. Although it's, I'll tell you the biggest difference was it just feels less satisfying. I'm so trigger happy on blog posts. I'm just like, write. And then I'm so used to the feeling of hitting publish and being like, dad, did it out, read my stuff. You know, like,
yeah.
And till this day, I'm terrible at. I really, even on CSS Tricks, it's big enough of a publication that I should have an editing workflow that articles go through, and they just don't. I just hit publish.
Yeah, let it fly.
Yeah, and there's, you know, I get emails about problems, and you know, I'd say every other week somebody sends me a like, you know, I respect you, but my respect for you diminishes each time you use the incorrect it's. You know, they like try to, they do, it's always like the most subversive, insulting possible way. Or they send you like 18 paragraphs on the difference between it's and it's or whatever. And you're like, I'm just trying to be a good citizen here. You know.
yep, you're doing well, actually. So, good job, I guess.
That doesn't happen here. That stuff happens. Like, I don't have to. If I had the wrong it's in there, it just got fixed. You know, like that wasn't the thing. The thing was keeping my foot out of my mouth. My worst offense in writing is to like refer to something that it wasn't clear, like to use it, but not have it be ultra clear what it is referring to in that sentence. Like I was bad at that.
Like. Obviously, this is like the Tuscan Raider invasion of 1822. We're all familiar. Next, is it like those kind of like weird, like you assume people know this things or
no, more like the directly like, and then you apply, then apply a filter to it. And it refers to something it? Very specifically. Yeah, like what is it in this case? I would be, and if you read through it, like you could maybe guess sometimes, but there's a lot of times where I was like, oh yeah, I really was not clear about that. And fixing it, you know, like maybe it wouldn't have destroyed the flow of that particular section, but fixing it just makes it feel so much smoother. So
yeah.
The whole book has that. It was really clear like that. So it feels and reads like me, you know, I think, but a better version of my voice. Yeah. In fact, I've gotten some of that feedback that it reads really clearly, you know, writing for humans kind of thing. I do have a casual style. So if you really hate that, you know, like slipping little jokes in and crap, definitely don't buy it. Yeah.
You probably didn't make it this far in this podcast.
Probably not.
And that's okay. It's okay if you don't listen to Shop Talk's show sometimes.
I would like to sell some copies of this book, though, so please buy it.
Yeah.
I would like to get to the point of profitability on this book. That would
be. It looks so good. I'm ready to read it. I mean, I just, it's always good to see how somebody else does something too, you know, just kind of how you think about SVG or what examples you find could be useful.
No, that, you know, that relates to conference talks too, in that people are worried, like, I can't give a talk about this. Everybody already knows this. And you're like, okay, A, they don't. But B, even if they did, people like to be kind of confirmed in what they know or see how you do it instead or be like, oh, thank God, I'm doing it that same way too, you know? Or like, oh, I've already given this talk somewhere else. They're seeing the same thing. No, they want to see the hits, man. They want, you know, or whatever. Like, don't all the things that you worry about in a conference talk, I think, you know, almost apply to book writing as well. Like, yes, I have said some of these things in other blog posts. I've said most of it in other blog posts. I'm saying it's smoother now. I'm saying it as part of a story now. I'm saying it with better examples and with a proper editor now.
See, that's great. That's nice. Well, cool. Well, congratulations, Chris.
Thanks. Thanks for letting me talk about it. Hijack the show, although it's our show, so I guess we can do that. We'll do it again when your book title drops. In fact,
you guys, Money-Driven Management. It's about using money credits to motivate employees.
I love that one. That's a classic one. You have a lot of joke titles, but behind the scenes, people, I've listened to some Dave ideas that are that really are money ideas. So I think there's one in your future for sure.
Speaking of money, let's go get it. Over to the advertisement.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Codascope Jax. Jax helps JavaScript developers secure their source code as they build their applications. Jax analyzes your GitHub repositories, highlights areas that can be improved, and provides expert training and patches to help you do it. It's free for developers to use on an unlimited number of repositories, so sign up today at codascope.com/shoptalk. Again, give it your GitHub repository. It gives you actionable recommendations for like writing smarter, more secure code all the way through the process of creating that repo.
And we're back. Chris, that was so good that we made money there.
And welcome to the people who skipped that early.
Yeah,
purchase.
Yeah. If you hit fast forward on your thing, you missed something hilarious. So you should hit rewind and listen to the ad again, you joker. All right, hey, let's get into some rapid fire. It's not all business here. So let's do some rapid fire. James Williams writes in. Hi there. I'm a front-end developer for a local software as a service company in Portland, Oregon. Up until now, our app has not been built to be a responsive web app. The nature of the product is cost analytics and deals with a lot of visualizations. Soon, we will be moving to having more mobile support, and I'm looking to use SAS and Suzy, aka Sassy Suzy, to handle the responsive grid. I was wondering if you had any experience using Suzy, and if and had any suggestions, ideas, pitfalls, etc., related to using it.
Called Sassy Suzy all of a sudden.
I think when you do like SAS and Suzy, it just comes out Sassy Suzy. For better or for worse.
Googling of that comes up with like a jewelry designer kind of thing. Usually it's just called Suzy. And it's
a really awesome YouTube channel. All right. So what do you have Suzy experience?
I do a little bit. We support it on CodePen as well because it was one of those SaaS, like we don't do SaaS add-ons very well, but we support some. So for example, you can like do add import compass in CodePen. You can add import Suzy as well. There's a handful of them and it's all explained in the settings area of a pen, but it's one of the few that we support because I am a big fan of it. I think it was probably the best SAS grid framework that, you know, came easily to mind. And I also just personally liked its approach that it wasn't, you know, there's kind of two types of grid frameworks. One of them is here's a whole bunch of class names that you can use at your desire to make a grid out of some HTML. It's just a chunk of CSS. That's a grid framework. Use it. Suzy did not do that. It gave you nothing, essentially. It's one of those, like, this is a tool to help you make a grid framework that's right for you, which I thought was pretty cool. So you can use any selectors that you want. It's like bring your own math, you know. And I think Miriam, who created it, was very clear about that. Like, this is just, it's just a math machine for generating column widths and stuff like that. And I always appreciated that because I usually like to bring my own class names to things. Mm-hmm. It just felt right. And then it's like producing the minimum amount of CSS and stuff that you need. Let's say you never use 1/8 width grids. Well, there's no CSS that has those. So you don't, there's no bloat or whatever. I like it, James. If you want to use it, use it. I rarely use a grid framework these days because Flexbox is so dang good, particularly at grids. It's rolling your own grid framework with Flexbox is just a handful of lines of code these days, and all the projects I work on happily use Flexbox without even a fallback. So I just rock Flexbox and write my own one, but I realize that some people need slightly deeper support than that. So if you need to go with a float-based system, definitely, Suzy is kind of the one to use, especially if you're already in SAS, because I think it's kind of only for SAS.
Yeah, I think my only, like, so I think Suzy is maybe the like pinnacle of like make your own grid thing, which if you're kind of doing a complicated web app and you have a lot of sidebars and floaty things, you're probably nervous about using like a out of the grid or out of the box grid. So I'd recommend Suzy. I think the only like downside would be that it's like another Ruby dependency. So and that could be good or bad. But if you're already working in Ruby, it's probably just fine. But yeah, so that would be my only like.
Yeah, and the just like, the learning curve is high-ish for a.
Yeah, because it's kind of its own custom DSL domain specific language. It's got its own little kind of markup properties that are non CSS properties, but it's. I think, like, in terms of, like, raw power of getting a grid to behave and work great, this is you want.
It's the one. So. It was such weird timing for Suzy to, like, really get good and popular right as Flexbox was getting more supported and stuff.
Because Flexbox does a lot of the math that Suzy kind of does, right? Because you're kind of saying, like, oh, this is, like... You know, Flexbox does this. Is that kind of the thing? Is Flexbox kind of has a similar math machine as
right? And you don't have to do the math because you can be like, well, I need five columns or whatever. I'm just going to do like flex one on all those columns and rock and roll. It makes five columns, but it doesn't, you know, things do get more complicated when you want, well, there's five columns, but you need four fixed width. What's in between a column?
A gutter
in between it. That can get a little bit more complicated. It's still made easier with Flexbox. It's not like Flexbox solves every single issue ever. So it can still get a little more complicated. I don't know if Suzy has a Flexbox option or not. There's still maybe a little bit of math involved, but much less.
I'm working on all Flexbox grid on my code pen. It's a work in progress. Don't tweet it or use it. But I'm just like, I wonder if I could just use Flexbox and Calc, and then my gutters can be whatever I specify, picks, VDHs, VWs, you know, like it just does it. And I'm kind of almost there. So I'm working through it. It's fun.
Well, I'd like to see it just because I wonder if there's a way to, I don't know, like I got to suspect there's some kind of like padding-ish kind of way where it just there's very little math that you let the computer do most of the math, but I'm not sure. Right. Maybe there isn't.
I'm sending you a top secret link that only you know about.
Okay.
Okay. To Superflex Grid. Work in progress.
All right. Well, thanks, James. Good luck with Suzy. I don't think you can go wrong. Even if you could use Flexbox, but just like the Suzy syntax and stuff. No shame. Use floats. Who cares? It's just a website.
Use it. Do it.
Let me read one. Adam Akers writes in, I am a self-learning front-end developer trying to build my first page/portfolio. Should I include a headshot or a photo of myself? I've seen arguments both for and against. What about a personal logo?
So
let's see. Can I find Dave's face on DaveRupert.com?
PersonalBrandingIssues.com. I get this. I understand this, Adam. I understand this issue. So,
okay, what would be the argument to not have your photo?
Well, so, I mean, it's weird, right? Because you have a photo of yourself on your website looking good, and it's almost like, oh, are we, like, talent? Like are we, like models or commercial actors or something that we need, like, headshots and photos? You know, are we a talent industry, or is it just, you know, are we a merit industry, like, where, I don't know, you just send really awesome emails and no one ever sees your face but people know you're good at
emailing. If you put your face, do you think you automatically get some trust points or something?
I wonder if you become a person, if that's a good thing.
Is it automatically good though or not?
I think it's automatically good. I think like your Twitter avatar should be, you know, your face, unless you have like privacy concerns. I've been getting into info security lately and I'm like, oh, I already messed up everything. You're supposed to be an anonymous troll for the rest of your life on the internet. I think like it's weird. I had a conference once, you know, request like a 1440 by 900 picture of me. And I was just like, that's like a wallpaper. Like I don't have wallpaper of myself. That's so weird. Why would I have wallpaper of myself? But I guess they just wanted a big image to kind of work with for the website, and they were going to color it and shop it or whatever. But that's so weird. But I think it's something conferences ask if you're like doing talks and stuff. If you're going to do a talk at a conference,
because they're going to see your face in real life anyway.
Yeah, if you're going to do a talk at a conference, you kind of need or they want to put your face on their website, kind of just to show who's going. I'm just using a photo I got from my friend Keegan Jones. He snapped a photo of me at a meetup, and I was like, "Hey, can I use this as like headshotty things?" And he was like, "Yeah, sure." So it doesn't have to be like, you don't have to sit down at the mall, the Walmart, and take like really good photos, you know, in front of a backdrop of lasers or anything. But you can, it can just be a very casual shot. I guess that's what I was also going to say. But you've done like the photo shoot before, haven't you, Chris? I remember a TV once falling on your head.
Yeah, that was kind of, God, why did I do that? I remember that photo
shoot,
but I can't remember.
The Kickstarter?
Maybe it was the Kickstarter. I just needed a good photo for some reason. I think it was kind of predated that. I don't know. That was weird, though, because it wasn't really like a headshot. Because I think what Adam is kind of asking about is like, I don't know, should I put my smiling mug right on my website kind of thing? And
go,
the photos
go down
I got.
To glamour shots and get a glamour shot, like windblown hair. Oh, that'd be so good.
That would be kind of sweet. But I would think these days, most phones in the world are so good that you can just freaking turn that thing around, rock a selfie, and be in good shape there for a photo that's worthy of being on your website. I guess I would err on doing it for the most part. I was wondering about like Paravel or whatever. Like, do you ever try to attract clients in such a way that them seeing a picture of three people is like, we want more than that, or you want to project an attitude than you are?
We have some photos. We've done photo shoots before where you just do them ourselves and they're weird, but they're good. Typekit. We're on Typekit. Because we use Typekit, and there's a bunch of scowly faces, and every once in a while they're like, wow, why is Paravel so mad to be on the Typekit website? But we're happy, but we're just trying to have an air of seriousness. If you go to ParavelInc.com/404, I think there's a Easter egg there for you. You just kind of need it, I think, at some point, just convey who you are or something. But I think it helps. I think it's something you will be asked for in your professional career. I know if I did a Net Magazine, and I had to hire a photographer and stuff. So my friend Jessica came out and took photos. So.
Oh, part of the deal.
Yeah.
I think we've mostly covered like reasons why you should do it. What are the reasons why you shouldn't?
I mean, I think you shouldn't if you have a security thing you're concerned about, like identity or whatever. Like, you'd rather remain anonymous for whatever reason. A good example of this would be Why the Lucky Stiff, if you remember Why from like Ruby on Railsy stuff, Ruby stuff, I guess. He preferred his anonymous life. So that's kind of admirable, you know.
So there's anonymous, and then there's like abuse type of stuff.
Yeah, I mean the Easter eggs and anime avatars and stuff that just throw abuse all over the internet.
It's like you wouldn't put it there if you wanted to do abuse.
Yeah,
but that's, you know, of course nobody is allowed to do that if you're listening to Shop Talk Show, you bastards.
But
what about the receiving of abuse? Do you think you get more or less of it if you have a photo?
Well, if you have a photo, you become less anonymous, right? I just said right in a way I don't like saying it, but you become less anonymous. You're offering this piece of information, like, this is what I look like. For you and I, Chris, it's probably fine. But, you know, if you're a woman.
For the most part, I have a weird troll on Instagram that if I ever post a selfie, they rear their head and tell me how fat I am. Literally every time.
That's so nice.
Yeah, it's a pleasant. Good one. So I was like, that'd be a reason not to, you know, if somebody's like, you're worried about people commenting on your appearance when they're absolutely not invited to.
Yeah, and I think women are probably more susceptible.
Oh, right.
Susceptible is not the right word, but just like, I don't know, more jags are going to show up to on a woman's feed than on a man's
feed.
For
sure. So. Okay, well, I don't know the answer, Adam. If you're not worried about it, let's see your smiling face. I'd err on yes unless you have a pretty clear reason not to.
Do it. Do it. That's what I'd say. Or just wait until somebody asks you for a photo and then do it. Then you'll know. But having a nice smiling face on a Twitter avatar isn't a bad thing. I know people get really militant about that, but it helps you feel like you're having a conversation on the Twitter, you know, and I'm not just talking to a Lego man or something. So, yeah, put your face on Twitter. Ding dong. Next question. Do we have time? Oh, we're kind of running out of time here. Okay, let's keep going. Matthias Meyer writes in, surely have heard about Google's accelerated mobile pages lately. The idea sounds nice to me, but having a tool set for really fast loading websites, but doesn't AMP warp us back to the days when you had separate site for mobile before responsive web design? AMP relies on JavaScript, so it does not progressively enhance. Thus, you can't build your desktop site with AMP if progressive enhancement is important to you. So you have different URLs for your desktop and mobile version. So you'd have to device sniff to redirect users appropriately and place links to the mobile site on each page and so on. You get the point. Any opinions on AMP?
Yeah. So it's basically this. It really is kind of funny to talk about because so much of the, like, what a 10K apart just launched. Did you see that?
Oh yeah.
Okay, so 10K apart, pretty cool. Like, make a website in 10K if you possibly can. I'm gonna read the complete rules. There's literally a line that just, oh, here it is. Build a compelling web experience that can be delivered in 10 kilobytes and works without JavaScript. So, like, the last three words there, works without JavaScript, is a thing that gets thrown around a lot. People think of that as what progressive enhancement is. And I think I've heard arguments for and against that kind of, that, you know, like, progressive enhancement is more than that kind of idea. But that, you know, here's a conversation setting event that's happening that uses works without JavaScript as kind of synonymous with progressive enhancement here. AMP literally does absolutely 100% depend on JavaScript because there's weird AMP tags in it that the browser totally won't understand on its own. Like angle bracket AMP dash image. The browser will just like shrug, don't know what that is. And it will be nothing on a website without JavaScript. Is it progressive enhancement? It's weird because they seem 100% at odds when you think of it that way, and 100% buddies when you think of it like the purpose of AMP existing is to have this like really trim, really fast, really efficient website.
Yeah. I mean, you get your content, you get the text and words, but AMP image would not load without JavaScript, right?
That's true.
So you couldn't have images. So if you think of that works for certain content sites. If you are XKCD, this doesn't work, right? So your content doesn't render in AMP, but it will eventually once the JavaScript has loaded and executed, and that should be somewhat fast.
Is that an argument against AMP, though? I mean, to me, AMP was a no-brainer, only because there's a really nice WordPress plugin for it, and you install it, and you turn it on, and it works, and now your pages are in AMP, too, and I don't necessarily, like, I have some advertising on the site, and that's great and all, but I don't bet long-term on display ads. I do multiple types of advertising, sponsorships of the site that come, the ads come across in the content as well. And so if you want to view my site in a really default AMP experience, I don't care. Good. Will it give me higher search rankings because I have it? Probably a little bit. Cool. It's going on.
But what does higher search get you if you can't monetize it?
Well, it is monetized because the sponsored content articles are amped up as well.
Okay. I guess, yeah, I'm not. So I heard AMP described as a nuclear bomb for the mobile web or like a pill, right? It's the most extreme treatment for making the mobile web faster, which it needs to compete with native, blah, blah, blah.
It'd be hard to argue against that.
Yeah, I suppose that makes sense. I think, though, I'm sort of with Matthias. I feel like it creates MDOTs part two. The M in AMP is MDOT. And every time I end up on an AMP site, I mean, it's nice. It loads fast. It is nice. But, like, you are getting, like, the junior version of the website, you know, like the header isn't the header, the, like, footer isn't the footer, you know, there's like you're getting a junior version of the website. That said, I think one of the byproducts of AMP will probably be that the ad world will get their crap together and like understand speed is imperative, and you know, all the tracking scripts and all that need to kind of simmer down. But I wish Google had like gone after themselves, like DoubleClick basically, and like said, hey, let's fix the web from the ads out, not mandate everyone has to use this thing, basically. Because now they're rolling it into regular search results. So if you, not just the little carousel thing, it's any search result will default to the AMP page.
That is kind of funny, because it's like, okay, maybe you can get some ads in there so you have some impressions, but ads aren't the only way that content websites kind of maintain their future, you know? For example, on CSS Tricks, we have a thing, and it's pretty non-obtrusive, but it's just like it's asking you at the bottom, is like, hey, we have a newsletter, do you want to sign up for it? That's not there on the AMP site. There's lots of other content to explore on CSS Tricks, so some of the people that we get through a search, if they're not on the AMP site, might be like, oh, interesting. They have a whole almanac here of CSS stuff. Oh, they have this whole snippet section thing. That's what you mean by baby website. Those people who come on the AMP site are never going to find those things. They're going to read and gone. It encourages a 100% bounce rate.
Yep. You're never getting. Yeah. So like the cure for a speedy website is getting you a 100% bounce rate. Which is kind of bad, right? You're not converting people to your newsletter. You're not converting people to whatever. It's just 100% bounce rate. And I think what I have issue with is when people are like, oh, we took ads out and we made the mobile web fast. Sure, if you take the money machine out of any machine, it's of course great. You know, like, oh, I took the whole sales department out of my company, and now my company is so much faster. I wonder what would be cool if
Google said, here's the thing. We're going to give you search engine bonus points for using AMP, but we're also going to look at your regular website. And if your regular website is about just as good as the AMP site is, we're going to give you the same bonus. You know, so it encourages you to like, okay, use AMP and you get a bonus for it. But if your regular website is awesome too, you're going to get the same bonus.
I don't know, man. I think the incentives are all tipped. I think, you know, because Google is hosting this content and Google is indexing this content and Google is an ad company and they want you to have a fast website so they can serve more ads. Like, I don't know. I feel like the incentives are all tipped when Google owns it. And somebody just posted, I wish I had these links off the top of my head. Somebody just posted, like, I don't hate AMP. I just hate that it's owned by one company, right?
Are we being fair in that? Don't they kind of, I mean, they do and don't in a way?
Like, Twitter was involved and they, like, went to a whole bunch of publishers and were like, hey, we'll give you the top spot on Google if you roll this thing out. And any publisher is going to be like, yes, because when you add something to a website, like if you add AMP, that's like a sprint, right? Or whatever. And so somebody gets a high five in the office for like rolling out a new feature. No one gets a high five for fixing performance and, you know, like reducing technical debt across the website, taking something out. You don't get awards for that. So, I don't know. I think like Twitter was involved, but like Google is hosting the JavaScript file you have to use. Google is caching the files on their CDN. Yeah,
they're the first that's saying these are going to start showing up in mobile search results.
Right, right. And so the thing is just going to tip. I mean, eventually Twitter will turn it on. And so like every time you click a link in Twitter, you don't go to the website, right. You go
it's
to
just
the
their version
website.
Of instant articles or whatever, which for the record I'd also turned on CSS Tricks, because I'm just like, as a, you know, that's just my role right now, is like, dude, whatever, I'll turn whatever you want on.
Right And that's, I think, any publisher's in that position where they have to get their content out in whatever silo possible, but, you know, I mean, at what point does it break your back? You know, I mean, it's easy now, but at what point, how many services do you have to support to where it's untenable?
Right. Soon. We're almost already there. Because it's not.
Yeah. If Snapchat's like, hey, Chris, we want all your content, but you got to use Snapchat fast, you know?
Yep.
And then you're like,
I'd probably draw the line there until enough people started like asking for it or whatever, or some plugin came along to help me support it. I'll tell you, it's already been a problem for me in the case that I wanted Apple News to work too, because I just, as an Apple person, I like Apple News and use it. So I was like, I should get my stuff on there, and there's an official plugin for it. Well, I couldn't get the official plugin working very good, so I moved to some other one. Or no, I think in this case, the official plugin worked pretty good, except for that about a third or more of my articles just fail for some reason, and there's a really bogus error code that doesn't help me fix it, and I don't know what it is. And it auto strips away all pre-tags, because pre-tags isn't like one of the like officially acceptable things.
Yeah,
and that's
pretty. Why would you need a pre-tag on a code blog?
Yeah, so it just strips it. But really, so what I need to do is like alter the plugin or write some code that like takes a pre-tag and replaces it with a P, but has all the inline styles that make it look like a pre or whatever. And I can't figure it out. Like, that's the kind of thing I should be able to do in WordPress, but I just can't figure it out. So, and it just is hard to deal with. So I'm just like, okay, screw it. And I'm not even sure that that's the only problem. There's a bunch of problems, and it just boggles my mind.
That's another thing with AMP is like invalid AMP page. You get a robot error, and it's just like,
yep,
that sucks.
So that's AMP, but AMP tends to work fairly well. But then there's instant articles as well, and I get about has the same problem. It strips pre-tags, yeah, and then it does some other thing. But they're all slightly different. I got some, you know, quote from a company to be like, hey, can you help me with all my have you worked with some other publisher? Is there some way to get a WordPress site auto-publishing really nicely to all these platforms? And they're like, oh, yeah, sure, like $50,000 or something. I was like,
oh, beautiful.
Like, I don't know. Maybe that's fair for a big publisher, but I just don't have that.
All right. Well, if you love AMP, leave a comment over at shopdocshow.com. I'd love to hear. I'm open, but I don't know.
No, you're right. Man. It's an MDOT. It's an MDOT.
And why are we like, oh, high five, a fast MDOT. That's it. We did it. We cracked the code. We solved the mystery. Anyway.
And an MDOT would say you have very little control.
Yeah. Yeah.
At least with an MDOT, you could control it.
I just feel like it's like Google's trying to be our boss, no, you can only use these elements, Dave. Ugh. And I'm like, you're not my boss, Twitter or Facebook or Google. You're not my boss. I'm going to make whatever I want. Anyhow, Chris, Skype is crashing, so I better go. Like, about literally, it just crashed because I touched the window with the mouse. So thanks everybody for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star heart, favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Tweet it, and people can hear about it on the Twitter sphere. Follow us on Twitter for tens of tweets a month at Shop Talk Show. We tweet out every Monday or Tuesday-ish when the new episode drops. So if you want to know when that happens, that's where we do that. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Get a brand new one. People want to hire people like you who listen to this show. And
that's a fact.
Yep. I'm telling you. I think it's positive. You put it on your resume. I listen to Shop Talk. And anyway, trying to figure out anything else. Chris, you got anything else? Go buy Chris's book, Practical SVG, over at bookapart.com and
shopdocshow.com.